During the past 30 years, I've had the honor and the opportunity of meeting many patients and many families with metabolic and mitochondrial disease. That has certainly been an education in itself. The other education that I've come to, that I gained, was really in how complicated and how broken the general healthcare system is. This is where we, this is what is supposed to be nurturing the patient community and keep it supported, but in fact, it doesn't. At the top of those, the physicians that are available to help patients, there's just not enough there. What I'd like to begin is, let's talk on what are possible options for medical care. I want to just go over the fact that ordinarily, one might think that in this field of medicine, there should be a bright future. There are many reasons for this. One is there is a growing awareness about metabolic disease and mitochondrial disease, especially in the pediatric community, less so in the adult community, but it is making gains. There are improved diagnostic capabilities, so new mechanisms for making a diagnosis. There are new treatment opportunities, again, both in metabolic and mitochondrial disease, things that weren't even conceived just a few years ago. That is the fact that we're talking about very specific beneficial treatments as opposed to just supportive care or vitamin therapies. The fact that we're actually thinking about very specific treatments for disease is very exciting. To counter those bright spots, we're faced with a growing patient population, which is good in the one sense, better to have a bigger population because they need to be recognized by the medical community. There remains a great shortage of clinicians and other health professionals in this area, so that there simply are an inadequate number in clinical practice. There are not enough trainees moving towards becoming practitioners. There isn't a lot of good recruitment of people to go into this area because it is a difficult area of medicine. It doesn't sell well to a medical student or a young health professional because these are long hours. There aren't a lot of people to cover you. The reimbursement is not good. There's not a lot of good incentive to go into this area of medicine. If there's not enough of us, that is the metabolic geneticists or those that are very familiar, expert in the area of mitochondrial disease, it's not as if there are a lot of specialists who can simply pick up the slack and fill in the void. That is part of the problem. A problem that's perhaps even more basic is the fact that education about metabolic and mitochondrial disease is poor at the medical school level, but is also poor and sometimes non-existent in many postgraduate training programs. It just doesn't exist, in part because the mentors in such programs never learned it themselves, so they certainly can't teach it to the young professionals. This combined situation doesn't bode well for the patient community or the physician community, only because patients, it's obvious that patients are not going to suffer because of the situation. In such an environment, physicians may not feel comfortable for very long carrying this burden, and at some point, they may just burn out. For the purposes of this conversation, I'd like to introduce the concept of a mito-knowledgeable physician. This is someone who has extensive expertise and experience in the diagnosis and management of mitochondrial disease. That's a mito-knowledgeable physician. Those kinds of clinicians are very rare. Then there's a mito-helpful physician. And a mental hospital physician is someone who has no particular expertise in metabolic or mitochondrial disease, but that's the kind, but this person is available. You might find him or her in a primary care practice or a specialty care practice associated with an academic medical center. They are physicians who are more comfortable taking on complicated cases. They get involved in the patient care. They're comfortable learning about a patient and disease. They're not afraid to get their hands wet in a case. They talk with other clinicians. They're willing to consult professional resources to help them. They are not the physicians who say, listen, I can only check your daughter's ears to rule out an ear infection, or I can only give vaccinations, but I can't do anything more. They will get very involved in the case. And so these are physicians who will learn more about the patient and the disease over time. And that is probably what is more realistic to look for, as opposed to a mito expert, since there's simply not enough of the latter. So some questions to ask I used to work with patients and families to, you know, set up an appointment with their PCP so that they can ask some important questions, which are you willing, and really have a conversation. You need to have this conversation, because if you're dealing with a physician who is not comfortable with these disorders, you don't want to find out 6 or 12 months down the road, because they're being passive aggressive and not returning your calls because they're afraid to talk to you because they don't know what's expected of them. It's worth having an open conversation with them, asking them if, you know, are you willing to participate in my care? Will you be comfortable working with other physicians if necessary? Can you help me understand what the other physicians are telling me and what they're, you know, what they think about my condition? Will you be able to advocate for me, whether it's to other providers or to the insurance company, to get, what is being prescribed for me? And can your office help to coordinate my care? Because these are the things that you really need done. And if they don't do it, you want to know about it so that you can look elsewhere, so that you know what you're actually dealing with. So there are a few, we are all familiar with conventional care, conventional medical care, which is where the patient deals directly with a metabolic doctor or a mito-knowledgeable doctor. That is conventional care. Then there's telemedicine care, which is where the patient deals long distance with a metabolic or mitochondrial doctor. So it's still direct care, but over distance. And then there's something that we're trying to advance and pioneer is the idea of telehealth physician-to-physician support, where it is the patient who sees a local doctor, either a primary care doctor or a local specialist, and a metabolic or a mitochondrial or mito-knowledgeable doctor talks with that local doctor so that that local doctor becomes sort of an apprentice over time. That local doctor is the one who is seeing the patient, face-to-face in his or her clinic, and assesses the patient and then learns from the metabolic doctor who's at a distance about what to look for and how to manage, so that over time, that doctor becomes more and more valuable to the patient. So let's get into that in a little bit more detail. If you think about what happens in a conventional direct care situation, so a patient goes to a hospital clinical setting and the metabolic or mitochondrial doctor evaluates the patient directly, gets a history, does a physical, reviews any information, and then develops an impression of what's going on, and puts out a list of recommendations, and those recommendations are implemented by both the patients, things that the patient needs to do once they leave the office, and by that mitochondrial doctor, who has a list on his or her, has a list of things to do, and does that after the patient leaves. And that's pretty conventional direct care. In telemedicine direct care, as I said before, it's a long-distance relationship between a metabolic or mitochondrial doctor and a patient. But it's very hard to just get right into a direct care situation. What is usually preferable is for there to be a live evaluation initially, where the metabolic or mitochondrial doctor actually gets to meet the patient, because not all patients are going to fit well into a long-distance care relationship. If there's a language problem, if there are technology problems, then a long-distance relationship is not going to work well. So there needs to be an initial live evaluation. And then if it seems that this can work over distance, then the patient can be at home and the doctor can be at the office there or wherever. And then after that initial live evaluation, the mitochondrial doctor evaluates the patient over distance. A history is obtained, no exam is performed because it's long distance, and the mitochondrial doctor can still evaluate other information that comes in. And again, like any direct care situation, an impression is developed, recommendations are made, and those recommendations are followed through by the patient or the mitochondrial doctor. Sometimes, another form similar to that, is the long distance, also direct care, but more of a second opinion. And this is a situation where the patient never ends up seeing the mitochondrial doctor, not even once. Usually, I guess there can be variations, but it doesn't have to. And the local doctor sends all the patient's information to a metabolic or mitochondrial doctor, who then reviews everything and then schedules a time to speak with the patient long distance. Now, that long distance connection may include some additional history taking. It does not include a physical exam because of the distance. And a list of recommendations are made, but it has to be understood that that kind of assessment is perhaps a slightly lower quality than a direct care relationship where the doctor's been following the patient for a long time. But still, one can get a good clinical impression, make a set of recommendations, and those recommendations are then sent from that second opinion to the local doctor. The local doctor can call the mitochondrial doctor and, ask questions for clarification. That certainly can happen. And then the recommendations are followed through, by the local doctor and the patient. And that relationship, there might not be a follow-up connection between the patient and the mitochondrial doctor anymore. That may be sort of a one-time consultation, or another arrangement can be set up. And then the final situation is a physician-to-physician support situation. And what that looks like is, again, the patient is evaluated locally by a mito-helpful doctor, so someone who is going to get involved, who is not afraid to ask questions or to talk and advocate on behalf of the patient. And that local doctor does a history and exam on the patient, and then the case is discussed in full between the mito-helpful doctor and the mito-knowledgeable doctor, and any additional patient information is reviewed then. The mito-knowledgeable doctor then gives a list of recommendations to the local doctor, and the mito-helpful doctor locally then makes a decision on with the patient on what should be done, what recommendations to follow through on, and it's up to the local team of patient and doctor to follow through. And then as, you know, the patient's in the course of that patient's disorder, you know, a follow-up appointment will be set up. And again, the myelohelpful doctor then can then consult with that same myelo-knowledgeable doctor for sort of with some updated information for additional guidance of where to go. So for those of you who are following the slides that I produced, the third last slide, slide 15, compares conventional care, telemedicine, and telehealth, and sort of highlights the kind of doctor who is doing the interacting with the patient. It's the mito or metabolic doctor who is dealing with the patient in the first situation, whether it's direct care, but in physicians of essential support, it's the mito helpful doctor that deals with the patient. The quality of the hands-on metabolic care is highest wherever the mito knowledgeable doctor actually deals directly with the patient. The problem is there are very few mito knowledgeable doctors, metabolic experts, and so the question is, do you never see someone who is going to help you with your metabolic or mitochondrial disease, or are you going to try and establish a relationship with a mito-helpful physician who can help work with you? And it may not be the highest level of care, but it's better than no connection with a metabolic or mito-expert at all. So that talks about, that addresses the issue of patient access. If you set your sights only on being able to access a metabolic expert, then you may or may not be able to make an appointment or get to see that physician or see that physician again, given the number of the patient's load and the fact that these physicians have only limited spots in their clinics. Insurance will pay for direct care. Insurance, you know, in the right situation, will also reimburse care for telemedicine care, and that has been done. Where you're dealing with a physician's and physician support service, there is no financial relationship between the patient and the mito doctor. That there's a contract instead between the mito doctor and the local institution or physician practice. So that way there's no direct relationship between the patients and the mito doctor. So I want to say how I am sympathetic and I feel so sorry for patients who can't access the kind of care they need and the fact that it's such a difficult and complex system. I fear that our system is only going to become only more complex with time, and as suggested by the current political environment, what is going to happen with healthcare in general is up in the air, but I suspect it's not going to make things easier for the rare disease community. I think what will happen is that you will start to see all kinds of innovative healthcare options evolve to see what works, what serves the patient well, and some are going to survive and thrive, and some are going to fail. But some of the points brought up in this talk in terms of what kind of doctor to find that can help you, I think it remains the same. And that is, look, you know, ask your doctor those questions. Tell the doctor what you need from them, so that you can find a doctor who can help you as much as possible. So I think I'm going to close there. I apologize if some of you think this has been too vague and that you were hoping for very direct guidance and direction on where to go. But this is an evolving field, and I guess I wish us all good luck in making things work.
Well, I love the explanations, Dr. Corson. Thank you very much. It definitely clarified, you know, some of the blurred lines in my mind, and I want to totally second your plea to find MITO-friendly and eventually work to MITO-knowledgeable team members in the absence or even in the presence of a MITO specialist being on your team. And we at MITO actually get many calls like, well, how do you do that? How do you know? And, you know, we actually recommend that you interview a practice, and you can do it through the staff, you know, maybe the nurse that's in charge, or even the, you know, a lot of the secretaries who have been around the block really know the feel for that practice, and, you know, maybe even eventually have that meeting with the doctor before being accepted as a patient to make sure it's a good fit, rather than spending 6 months or a year in a practice and then realizing this just isn't the right fit for me. So we really do recommend that take the time, make the calls, and, you know, are you willing to take a complex patient? Have you ever heard of mitochondrial disease? Are you willing to learn about it? Not having treated it shouldn't be a deal breaker if it's a energetic doctor who's willing to go out and learn and educate himself. And I knew we had it, you know, made when one of my daughter's physicians, who was not initially MITO-knowledgeable, told us that she went to a MITO conference just for my daughter, like with my daughter in mind. And I'm like, that's it. That's the kind of doctor that you want on your team. She became more and more comfortable with all aspects of it by taking it upon herself to educate. So definitely the patients have to do a little bit of their own legwork and, you know, work not only to find that right doctor, but to work to cultivate that relationship. You have to, you know, be a good communicator as well and give them a little time and space to make those learning adjustments. I'd like to just remind the callers, you can email me your questions at marybeth, M-A-R-Y-B-E-T-H, at mitoaction.org, and I will voice the question for you. So let me start with a question that has come in, Dr. Corson, if I may.
Okay.
In any other countries or regions of the world that practice metabolic medicine, or do they practice it well in terms of reimbursement and preventing that burnout that you described, that sort of we could start to copy that country or region?
Well, that's a good question. Are there other countries that do it better? Well, in some ways, there are more physicians, I think, in concentration of physicians, at least in metabolic care. I'm not sure about mitochondrial care, but at least in metabolic care, I would say in Europe. But they're simply, they have a different training system, and so that's, I think perhaps there's a little bit more exposure and experience. I would say still it's more in the area of pediatrics than adults, but I think even there, clinics become large. You know, that there's, you know, in Europe, this newborn screening, which feeds our clinics here in North America with you know, a growing number of patients each year, about 1,500 new patients being identified by newborn screening in the United States, or thereabouts. That isn't happening in Europe because they have a far more focused newborn screening program. So clinics there aren't growing quite as fast. But this is an international problem. There's simply not enough physicians or clinicians available to satisfy the need of the patient community at this time. You know, add to that, there's a growing awareness in developing countries as well, which have even fewer supports. So there isn't a good answer. There isn't a good answer elsewhere, not at this time.
Okay. That's what I figured, or we would have been all over, but I know you have traveled around, so you have seen more of what's out there. I think mitochondrial disease is still relatively young, and it will take just time, education, awareness. I mean, I know that medical schools are just starting to consistently even teach about mitochondrial disease and sort of more of that big impact that all the metabolic issues have. Definitely a tough one. I have a question from Chris, and he wondered about the telehealth doctor-to-doctor about liability issues. Would any of the local doctors be afraid to sort of take on more just due to liability? This isn't their specialty, and they're just sort of doing what someone else said.
Well, I mean, it's a good question, the question of liability. You know, but it is unlikely that someone who is frightened of being associated with or of treating a complex patient, it's unlikely that they're going to engage in this conversation, in this kind of conversational relationship about this patient. It is much more likely to be those physicians or clinicians that embrace complex patients. And they know that either they're going to take care of this patient themselves and they're going to get frustrated or feel like a little helpless because they're not being able to provide adequate care, or they're going to get somebody else involved. So I think liability is going to be less of an issue. On the other hand, this is a new type of relationship. This kind of ongoing physician-to-physician support is going to be unusual. You know, physicians helping physicians happens all the time. I mean, if I had a patient that had a particular disorder with which I had no expertise, I wouldn't hesitate to pick up, you know, the phone and speak to somebody about it who could help me and think it through and figure out an approach. That happens all the time now. But to happen on a regular basis, on the same patient or a set of patients over time, that is unusual, and it's going to take a little time, I think, for physicians to grow comfortable with the concept and find out that it's helpful and it doesn't really put them at very much risk at all. However, we recognize, those of us who are engaging in telehealth support, recognize that it is very likely that our names will appear in the patient medical record. And as such, we will, have liability insurance and malpractice insurance, you know, just in case, despite everyone's best intentions. You know, we take it seriously. We recognize that we'll be involved in the medical record of a patient we may never see. So, but the point is, we can't let liability determine whether or not patients get care. That's simply, if you do it that way, no one's going to get care. So we have to find ways to get around that.
I agree. So it sounds like education of existing physicians out already practicing will be a key part of these steps forward, that they have to embrace this, not sort of let it hurt their egos or, you know, whatever other stumbling blocks they may have, instead of just sort of turning a blind eye to that part of their patient. So,
yes, and the truth is, this is going to happen in other areas of medicine too, and it, in fact, is already happening in other underserved areas of medicine, whether it's psychiatry, whether it's, you know, pediatric rheumatology. There's several areas of medicine that simply don't have enough clinicians to satisfy the population, the patient need. So this is inevitable. And you should know that the federal government here actually is supporting actively the establishment of telehealth services to improve access of patients to genetic services. There are actually seven regional genetic districts in the country, and to receive federal funding, they must show evidence that they are increasing access to genetic services using telehealth or telemedicine technology. So there is a drive to increase access to expertise.
I agree, and I am sure that both you and I can attest to the families and patients and adults who have participated in some form of telemedicine. They absolutely love it because it saves so much, basically, energy from getting to appointments and, you know, travel, especially if it's an extended travel. It's just, the advantage to a patient really can be great. And even expenses, to not have the expenses of travel.
Right.
And the germs and just so many levels of this being a good thing. So,
oh, absolutely. I remember we had one family where we stopped seeing him because every time he came to the clinic, he would get sick. And when he got sick, he would get very, very ill and require a prolonged hospitalization. The parents at some point stopped coming to the clinic because it wasn't worth exposing the child. And so that evolved into a natural long-distance relationship just to support the health of the child.
That's awesome. I love that. You saw a problem, you came up with a solution. That was the child. So I think that is awesome. I had a question here that came in about how does the insurance coverage or, you know, whatever work, when, especially when it's doctor to doctor, and but it's official, not just you calling up your favorite endocrinologist and saying, hey, I have this, you know, weird thing going on. But when you have an established relationship, how does the patient's insurance coverage kick in, or is it just something that that doctor's office starts to absorb?
That's correct. The patient's insurance doesn't cover it at all, at least not at this time. That may change over time if there are certain areas of the country that certainly are just not served by this. And so if this offers the only way of providing care, maybe insurance companies will consider that, but for the most part, that doesn't exist now. So the way this handles it is all the patient interaction is with a local physician, and so insurance pays for that, reimburses that kind of care. It is the institution who independently contracts, or the physician practice that independently contracts with the metabolic or mitochondrial doctor. The institution or practice determines whether it is more valuable to take on a metabolic or mitochondrial expert at their institution and pay all the costs associated with salary and benefits, or that it simply just makes more sense to contract with a doctor to help out as needed. And so that's where a lot of institutions are realizing it makes more financial sense to do it that way, spend a lot less, more money, but actually, in the end, improve access to that expertise, even if that person is not on site.
That's a good point, especially given that taking out a new position, not only the salary costs, but the office space, the insurance, the benefits that all go with it, it's really quite an expense. So that is a very good way to look at it. Thank you for clarifying that. The next two questions I have, and again, let me remind anyone who has a question to just email it to marybeth@mitoaction.org, and I will voice it, are really along the same line, so I'll read them both, and then you can have at it. So first one is, what if I cannot find a mito helpful doctor? And the second, along the same line, the changes in the position of primary care physicians within the health system has meant that my last two PC physicians have become less and less interested in pursuing answers for my unusual medical needs, even for finding specialists for treatment. What specialty may be more inclined to work with a rare disease patient?
All right. Well, I guess... So the question is, you know, I don't know the specifics of the case, but what I would say is, you know, maybe you're looking in the wrong places. That I would go again. You are not going to find a person. You're less likely that you will find a physician in a private community practice who wants to take on this kind of care. You're probably more likely to find a doctor who is associated with an academic medical center, and is worth calling the the practice coordinator or the nurse in charge who might be able to tell you a little bit about the personalities of the doctors and the kinds of patients that they deal with. And that would be the way to approach it. Now, the truth is, there is a style for how to deal with a doctor. I mean, if, you know, think of it from their standpoint. If you drop, 6 inches of paper in front of them on the first meeting, and, you're going to overwhelm them. And remember, you're dealing with humans. They are human beings, and with all the strengths and weaknesses that human beings have. So I think it's important to, carefully introduce them to the range of problems, prioritize ones, and, sticking perhaps with the, sure, make them aware of all the, all the problems, but help them prioritize your problems so that you're dealing with maybe two or three problems at a time. Simply because, again, if a doctor is completely overwhelmed, then they're not going to be in this for the long term. So, and I think you should go into this with the idea of this being a long-term relationship. So how you want them to take care of you, how are you going to take care of them? So that, again, they're not overwhelmed by what you're presenting. The other thing is sometimes, and it's easy to understand, when patients are dealing with such an obstructive, unsympathetic system, it's easy for patients to come in frustrated, to vent their anger, maybe not at the physician, but the physician happens to be the one in front of them at the time. And it's easy for that to happen, and which is unfortunate for everybody because, the patient doesn't get what he or she wants, and the physician is sort of feeling, doesn't understand why they're seeing this frustration. So it's a matter of making sure that, again, if you want them to invest in you, put some attention into figuring out how you can support them in supporting you. And I know that sounds sort of weird that the patient needs to take care of the physician, but the thing is, you are investing in that physician. You want the physician to invest in you, and so anybody who's going to invest in you, you sort of have to take care of a little bit. That strategy can be extremely successful in the long term. But why that should have to happen at all, and why can't patients simply and families simply just get the care they need without having to jump hoops? I'm sorry that it can't be easier, and I apologize for that.
And I'm sure most people on the call will sort of feel that frustration with having to be both a little bit of the caregiver as well as the care receiver, but also I think that's how relationships develop, and I try and keep in mind how incredibly stressed and busy and overwhelmed the physicians are, and that, many, especially in these specialties where there's not a lot of support and not, a lot of either financial support or even, backup, like you're on call every single day because there's no one else in your region. And for us to keep in mind that they do need nurturing too, because burnout is real and we've seen it over and over. And then, the physicians, for their own sanity, have to see less patients, turn people away, close their doors permanently. So I agree, and we do have a lot of resources on our website just about how to make those appointments most effective. Just like you said, not walking in with four binders that all of a sudden, you could see the physician go, holy cow, I'll never get through this in 30 minutes or 1 hour or however much time they have, and just prioritizing your questions and being as organized and trying to almost predict what those questions will be so that you do have those answers on hand. Yes, there was an MRI. Oh, yes, we did do a muscle biopsy, and here are the results, or whatever it is, but maybe not bringing in every set of labs that were normal or, you know, other things, you know, every, whatever, temperature graph when that's not your issue or something like that. So that's, I do see it as that two-way street, and I do feel like, you know, physicians have become, not all of them, but many, you know, a little shorter with patients, and that they too, if they could take a breath and realize the stress that the families are under, I think both sides of the street would just work so much better together, and it would benefit both sides, you know, the physicians, because I think the families are not bad guys, and I think the physicians are not bad guys either. And sometimes we bring out the worst in each other, and sometimes, hopefully, we bring out the best in each other as well, but...
Absolutely. And the other thing is, once you get attached to a practice, and certainly if you're interviewing the physician and interviewing the practice, you will learn what other resources are available. And some of those needs that you have as a patient don't really have to fall to the doctor at all. It may fall to the nurse or the genetic counselor or the practice coordinator or somebody else who could serve those purposes. For example, the very, you know, very practical sense, if you're coming back to the center for three different appointments to see three different physicians or specialists, and you want someone to coordinate that, you're coming back on one day to do all that, and so you're making one trip instead of three, it's not the physician that's going to do that. It's going to be the person who, you know, schedules the appointments. If you can engage them, you know, that's the person in that practice who can help you there.
Mm-hmm. And I know that, in general, Dr. Kendall's practice is very wise about referring patients to MitoAction or other, you know, support type groups, education, advocacy, for the parts that we can cover. How do you live with this disease? How can I take what Dr. Kendall or Dr. whoever said and put it into real practice? And sometimes even using... other, as you said, other resources available in your community to help complement the care you are getting is quite helpful. Okay, I do have another question that came in. I'll let you take this one. Which are the 7 regions for metabolic care?
So these are 7 regions determined by the federal government, and they're geographical regions. So they are the New England region, which are the 6 New England states, the Mid-Atlantic region, including New York and Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware. There is the Southeast region, so the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, over, you know, Alabama, Mississippi through to Louisiana. There's the Heartland region, which are the Midwestern states. There is the Mountain region, which goes all the way from Montana through down and over to Texas. And there is the Western region, which includes Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington, Oregon, and California. I think that's 5 or 6, is that 6 or 7? But if you go on to, if you look up the Human Resources Services Administration, so HRSA, H-R-S-A, it's a federal, it's a government website, and it'll talk about, if you look up, or if you look up the, you know, 7 regional genetic, 7 genetic regions in the United States, you'll come across that map. And some actually are very involved. The Heartland region, which again is the mid part of the country, the Midwest part of the country, and the Mountain states have more experience in telemedicine already because of the big distances that already exist. So they have telemedicine services set up already. More in the area of genetics, not in the area of metabolism, but more in the area of genetics. But you'll find more information there. And we've been encouraging, you know, if any clinics or regions are willing to set up telehealth services, whether it's with us or you know, on their own, again, there is funding for that. So, so we would encourage them to take care, to take advantage of that.
Very interesting. All right. Well, thank you. And I do have one more question if you have time. It has to do with just reimbursement and how better to validate the financial value that metabolic or mitochondrial doctors bring to a hospital. Because it does seem that they order neuro-ophthalmology testing, but then the neuro-ophthalmology department gets all that money and the metabolic clinic looks kind of paper poor as far as what they bring in because they don't order big deal medications that cost a lot yet, you know, that pharma company can help support. And it seems like most of the testing, they go to see GI. GI gets that money. Go to cardiology. Cardiology gets that money. So how can, on paper, not patients can change this, but even the medical establishment change just the value that the microdocs really do bring to these facilities?
Well, if all the metabolic doctors in the country were on this call and they held a microphone, you would have heard a huge sigh. Because this is everybody asks the same questions. You know, metabolic disease, mitochondrial disease, is a labor-intensive area of medicine. It's a lot of time spent on a relatively small number of patients. And that doesn't look well on paper, on a financial ledger. And sure, we may be the portal. Our service might be the portal where patients enter a hospital system, and then we evaluate the patient, put all the time in, and then make all kinds of referrals, which, you know, and so the insurance pays the specialist, the insurance pays the lab, and the insurance pays the MRI, and the insurance pays the surgeon, but we get very relatively little. A lot of hospitals say they acknowledge the business that is generated by the genetics patients. Often that doesn't materialize into credits, actual financial credits to the service, to the metabolic or the genetic service. It does support the need to continue the service, but doesn't necessarily improve the financial situation or the financial status of the genetic clinic. There are a very few number of hospitals where they have taken the time to actually track what happens to the patients after they are seen in genetics and recognize that each genetic patient brings in a significant amount of insurance revenue to the hospital. And though in those situations, the clinics are in fact well supported, but that is a rarity at this time. I'm not sure what to do with that, except that it's an ongoing fight. There have been publications by the American College of Medical Genetics, or sponsored by that, as well as others, to document what the genetic services bring in to a hospital, but that just doesn't seem to carry enough weight to change reimbursement at the insurance level or support at the hospital level. So we haven't succeeded there yet.
It seems like hopefully they will get that word in. I know I just reviewed the newest medical mitochondrial society's paper on ongoing care, and you should see an ophthalmologist this frequently. You need to make sure that you get an echocardiogram this frequently. Make sure that you see someone for your mental health, and just those avenues of, you know, revenue just for keeping your patients healthy and being proactive, it seems like it should reflect back on the person who figured this all out, for sure. I know other parts of business, you know, they definitely have learned better how to follow that dollar, and unfortunately, I believe that we're forcing our physicians to be also businessmen.
Right.
Maybe they're not. Maybe they just want to use their science and be a true physician, caring, working, and hope that the business end is taken care of, you know, whether it's through the hospital or which other avenue, so they can do what they're good at. But unfortunately.
And that is part of the problem, is that physicians are not trained in business. And so we often don't play enough of a role in determining the business structure of a clinical practice. And so we become, unfortunately, we become victims in the process because we don't know what we're doing. I would say, though, that in some other countries, including Canada, there is better reimbursement for physicians and caregivers. There isn't the discrepancy. You know, people here often talk about how surgeons make so much more than medical physicians because it's very procedure-oriented. That is much less the case in Canada, where the medical and surgical worlds are, closer aligned, and they're more equal in terms of reimbursement and support.
Mm-hmm.
So it is actually better there.
Definitely have to keep on that. I have one final question, if I may, that has come in from the West Coast. There is funding for telemedicine, as you had said. Who provides that funding if it's not the insurance?
So funding for telemedicine, again, what I was talking about is HRSA, HRSA actually provides each of the 7 genetic regions with funding that supports efforts to increase access to genetic services in that region. And in the budget demands that were put out last September, so this is a year ago, for the 3-year cycle that began this past June, a priority was to support the expansion and development of telehealth services, whether that is physicians and physician support or actual telemedicine direct care. So, if you look up HRSA, you look up the 7 genetic regions, you will find out the coordinator in each region who could perhaps provide more information about what efforts are being done in your region.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Corson, thank you so much for giving us a portion of your day. I realize how busy you are and that you really are all over the world helping metabolic patients. And, you know, as a patient care provider, as a doctor-to-doctor educator, as a part of MitoAction's Medical Advisory Board, and, you know, helping us all along through the years, we just truly appreciate all you do for our community. I just really can't put enough emphasis on, you know, how many people just so respect what you've done for either their health care or mitochondrial disease as a whole. So thank you so very much.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. I hope to talk to you again sometime.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I'll hold you to that.
Okay.
All right. Well, on behalf of everyone on the call, I just really would like to say have a great holiday season and Happy New Year, and we will look forward to 2018 and what you guys are all bringing down the pipeline.
Okay, Doug. Thank you.
All right. Sure.
Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.